Even here, time doesn't hold forever, Tia told her. Choose. Kelsey turned numbly back to the panorama before her, skipping through the scenes, her mind moving faster than it had ever moved until she found what she was looking for. Katie and Jonathan, sitting in a dank room. The room was lightless, but Kelsey could see them, both asleep, Jonathan with his head on Katie's shoulder. This, Kelsey told Tia, I choose this. She held up Finn's sapphire. The Queen of Spades was there, hovering, but Kelsey did not fear her any longer. The things Kelsey could not do, the things that needed to be done, these were her province. Both of them had been born in anger. Coming home. You're sure? Tyr asked. Yes. Then luck to you, child. He patted her shoulder. One day, perhaps, when your time is done, we will meet again. I see you have a story to tell, and I would like to hear it. Kelsey's eyes filled with tears. She turned to thank him. But Tyr was gone. Chapter 15. The Tierling. The Early History of the Tierling, as Told by. In the dark of the cell, Katie woke with a start from the strangest dream of her life. She had been talking to Jonathan's mother, the two of them wrapped in mist, not the white mist that covered the town when autumn crept down from the mountains, but a thick curtain of dark grey. You could stare into that mist for 100 years in 100 directions and not be able to find your way out. I need your help, Lily told her, and Katie nodded. It was only a dream, after all. She should have been afraid, for Lily was long dead, 3 years. But Katie was not afraid. She had always loved Lily in life, and she could not believe that Lily's ghost meant to harm her now. This was not to say that this version of Lily was not frightening. From time to time, Lily would blink, and Katie would glimpse something else beneath the surface. Something terrible. This Lily was not kind, not understanding, but vengeful. But Katie did not think it was revenge against her that Lily sought. She hoped not. She felt as though at any moment Lily might shed her skin and reveal something entirely other, a black and slumped shape that wore Lily as a mask. What kind of help? She asked, but she was only partly listening. The other half of her mind was tuned back into the cell, waiting for the click of a key in the lock, the sign that Ro had come for them. She thought she would promise Lily anything, if only it would get her out of this place and back to Jonathan. Katie stared at Lily's face, seeking clues, but she saw only a deadly sort of patience. And now she noticed something else. Lily was wearing a crown, a silver circle studded with blue jewels. Rose crown. And Katie suddenly relaxed, because this seemed the most indisputable proof that this was a harmless dream. Rose crown could not be here, on Lily's head. Katie had buried the thing in the woods, and it would remain there forever, unable to harm anyone. I need to be here, Lily said. I need you to allow me to be here. Katie's brow furrowed, but she nodded, almost in a trance, allowing Lily's voice to drift over her. For a few moments, she became confused, thought she was speaking not to Lily but to William Tyr. Then the world locked solidly back into place, and she blinked stupidly as light flared above her head. She had spent hours waiting for the click of the lock, and she had missed it. Gavin and his four flunkies stood above them, all of them holding torches in one hand and knives in the other. Too many for Katie to take, even if she'd had her own knife. "Get up," Gavin ordered tonelessly. "He wants to see you." He bent down to take her arm, but Katie shook him off. "Don't touch me, traitor." "I'm no traitor. I'm helping to save this town." She gritted her teeth, wondering how he could be so blind, so stupid. Katie wasn't sure of what the town needed either, but she knew that whatever it might be, it would not come from Roe, who only wanted all things for himself. But Gavin's face was smug and certain. Katie longed to punch him. She clenched her hand into a fist, then froze, puzzled, as her hand unclenched of its own volition. Something shifted, restless inside her mind, and then it was still. "Did I dream?" Katie wondered. "Did I dream all of that?" "Come on," Gavin said. "Follow Lear." Katie did, wondering why they didn't bind her hands. There had been a dream, she remembered now, but she was damned if she could remember what it had been. As she tromped up the staircase, a long staircase, many more stairs than any similar structure she had ever seen in the town, she felt a thud as something heavy bounced off her breastbone. Tyr's sapphire. Of course, still tucked beneath her shirt. Jonathan had given it to her during that long, dreamlike interlude in the dark. Katie wondered whether she was dreaming now. If only she could wake up in her own narrow bed, her book next to her on the bedside table, and Mum in the next room. If only that were how this ended. She glanced at Jonathan, and found him pale, but composed. The torchlight flickered, and for a moment every line of his cheekbones was limned in grey, his face a skull. Katie nearly gasped, but remained quiet as she felt his hand twine with hers in the dark. "We tried, Katie," he whispered, the words nearly inaudible. "We did our best." She turned to stare at him, but Jonathan was looking straight ahead, focused on the future, hardly noticing that his words had stabbed her in the heart, put her right back in the clearing, 15 years old, that day when she and Jonathan had been the only ones left behind. If only she could go back there. There was so much they could have done differently, starting with Roe. Katie could have strangled him in the woods, buried his body with no one to know. Tyr wouldn't have wanted that. Tyr is dead. Why should he bind us any longer? There was no answer, only that sense of movement deep in her mind, a slither of thoughts that were not her own. For a moment, the tangle loosened and a single thought came through. Spades. And then it was gone. They reached the top and found themselves in a long, cramped hallway lit by torches. Katie glanced behind them but saw only the beginning of the staircase, a wide mouth that yawned downward into darkness. How many people? Katie wondered suddenly. Roe didn't build that dungeon for Jonathan and me. Christ, how many people has he kept down there? As they neared the end of the hallway, a long, narrow shadow fell through the doorway, and Katie tensed, preparing to go for Alain's knife. He had always been the weakest fighter among them. Even though Gavin would likely knife her in seconds, perhaps she would have the time to put a blade through Roe's heart. It would be worth dying herself. But it wasn't Roe. Katie had been deceived by the shadow. The form that came through the doorway was a little boy, less than 4 feet tall. But Katie had to squint at him for a long moment before she recognized Yusuf Mansour. "What the fuck?" she spat at Gavin. "What have you done to him?" Gavin looked away, and Katie realized, disgusted, that he didn't even know. The Yusuf Katie knew had been a sweet boy, bright with numbers and eager to please. The creature before her now had Yusuf's face, but that was where the resemblance ended. He was pale, so pale that his skin almost appeared white, and his eyes were dark, fathomless hollows. He did not smile or show any other sign of recognition, only stared at the group. And as they moved toward the door, Katie saw with alarm that Yusuf's eyes were fixed on Jonathan. The last thing she remembered was walking through the doorway. Roland Finn had pictured this moment in his head so many times that when it came, he almost expected it to be disappointing. Here was Jonathan Tyr, the favored son. Oh, and his heart still burned at the unfairness of that. Tyr had given the town nothing. And here was Katie, her head bowed. And that was right, too, because Katie of all people should have been penitent. Katie looked up, and Roe felt his equilibrium vanish. The lightest touch of fear seemed to breathe on the back of his neck. Katie was supposed to be sorry. For years, whenever he had imagined this moment, he had known that first. Katie would be sorry that she hadn't come with him. Her posture was right, cringing and defeated. But her face was all wrong. She stared at him with no expression, her face almost blank, as if with shock. She didn't seem to know where she was. Roe turned to Gavin, who stood nearby with a pathetically eager look on his face. Unlike Katie, Gavin performed perfectly, like a puppet. Only shake a string and he would do as he was told.
"What's the matter with her? Is she drugged? Beaten?"
"No," Gavin replied. "We didn't touch her." Roe dismissed that, turning to Jonathan.
"You, where's William Tyr's sapphire?"
Tyr raised his eyes, and Roe recoiled at the pity on his face. Jonathan Tyr did not get to feel sorry for him. Not now. Not when Roe had won.
"You will give it to me," he told Jonathan. "No one is beyond the reach of pain. Not even a tear."
At that, Katie stirred slightly, and Roe saw something, a ripple beneath that drugged expression on her face. Then she was still. A distant alarm seemed to go off inside him. It was almost as though she were in a trance. But Katie didn't have trances. She had never had any gifts. Roe turned back to Tyr.
"Give it to me."
"No," Tyr replied, almost wearily. "If you're going to kill me, may as well do it now. You won't have it." Roe frowned. He didn't dare actually take the jewel. That was the hell of it. His own sapphire worked, but only sporadically, inconsistently. Nothing like the power he had felt when he held Tyr's jewel. And yet, it had never occurred to him to simply kill Jonathan and take the thing. He knew it could not be that easy. Nothing ever was. But beneath the knowledge was a deeper certainty. Any magic that could be seized by force was hardly worth having. Roe had earned his power, had been honing it for years. No one could simply walk in and take it away. He snapped his fingers at Yusuf, who darted forward, his face twisting in a bestial grin. That grin chilled Ro, yet he couldn't help but feel an almost paternal pride. This child, who was no longer a child at all, was his own creation. He had two more under construction, deep in the catacombs he had dug beneath the church, but even these three were nothing compared to what he could make. There would be so many more. He had hoped that the sight of Yusuf would wipe the pity from Tyr's face, but here again he was disappointed. Jonathan merely stared at the child for a long moment, then said, "So this is what you've been doing in the dark. Even my father didn't think you would stoop this low." Ro clenched his fists. Even now, after all these years, he hated this idea that William Tyr would have talked about him behind his back, talked about him in the very bosom of that family from which Ro had always been excluded. Tyr, Lily, Jonathan, Katie, the rice bitch, all of them had been on the inside, and he had been out. He turned back to Katie, who continued to appear almost catatonic. She had stolen his crown. She knew where it was, but Ro knew he would not get that information without a fight. Jonathan's pain would be doubly useful here. But now, staring into Katie's muddled eyes, he wondered if she was even capable of understanding that Jonathan was being tortured. Would she even notice? "It wasn't supposed to work this way, damn it," he thought again. "She was supposed to cry. Both of them were supposed to be afraid." He snapped his fingers in front of Katie's face, but she ignored him. Instead, she turned to Jonathan, extending her hand, and Jonathan took it. Jealousy, kitten-clawed, scratched its way down Rose's spine. He didn't like the way Katie and Jonathan were looking at each other, communicating without talking. Once, that had been the two of them, Ro and Katie. In a town that had forgotten him, only Katie had seen him clearly. The longer she and Jonathan kept looking at each other that way, the more uneasy he became, until he finally told Lear, "Break them apart." Lear grabbed Katie and tugged her away. Katie looked up, and Ro took a step backward. Her face was a wild bloom of colour, and her eyes had narrowed to bright green slits. In the next moment, she leapt across the room and attacked Jonathan. Ro stared at this development, too shocked to respond. He had ordered Gavin to keep an extra close watch on her, assuming that if she went for anyone, it would be himself. But now she was grappling with Tyr, climbing his back. Lear and Gavin and the others stood frozen, their mouths gaping, as Katie gritted her teeth and wrapped her arms around Tyr's neck. Tyr didn't even fight her off, only stood there, gasping for breath, and at the last minute, Ro realized what was happening and jumped forward. But it was too late. The snap of Tyr's neck was almost deafening in the high, hollow emptiness of the church. Katie dropped him, and the body slumped to the ground, eyes wide open and staring. "God help us!" Gavin shouted, and Ro wanted to tell him to shut up. Only a fool like Gavin would still believe in God at this of all moments, but he bit his tongue. He might need Gavin now. Katie stared down at Tyr's body, her shoulders heaving, and Ro watched her, feeling as though he had never seen her before. "Katie?" he asked. She looked up, and Alain began to shriek. Katie's mouth was wide open, so wide that she appeared to be screaming herself. As Roe watched, the hole opened wider and wider, growing in circumference until it seemed that her mouth must swallow her head. Her eyes and nose tipped backward until they seemed to be first on top of her head, then behind it. The open mouth grew into a black hole, and Ro watched, frozen in horror, as first a hand emerged, then an arm. Alain bolted from the room, still screaming, Howell and Morgan right behind him. Gavin and Lear stayed put, but Gavin had drawn into the corner of the pulpit, wrapping his arms around himself, his eyes wide and bruised as he watched Katie transform. Now a shoulder had emerged, and while Ro watched, the edges of the hole rippled and a head pushed its way through. And as he glimpsed the face, Ro screamed himself. The dead didn't frighten him. He had been dealing with corpses for years. The dead didn't frighten him. But this was no corpse. This was a ghost. Lily Freeman had emerged from Katie's form, shedding it as easily as a snake sheds its skin, leaving Katie's behind a small heap discarded on the floor. Lily was naked, her body streaked with black like smears of earth, her long dark hair unbound, not the woman Ro had known, but someone much younger. He had seen this Lily before, in the portrait that hung in the Tears' front room. Several times, Ro had snuck in to explore the Tear house when no one was home, and the portrait of Lily had always struck him, though he couldn't say why. However little use Ro had for his mother, he had always been able to feel her anger when he looked at that picture, at the wildly happy Lily, who had ruined everything, taken everything that the Finns should have had. Lily was wearing his crown. Ro stared at its glinting blue and silver, horrified. He had been ready to commit murder to get it back, even to torture Katie if it came to that. But he could no more snatch the thing off a ghost's head than he could have taken the jewel from around Jonathan Tyr's neck. It might as well have been on the moon. She turned to look at him, and Ro screamed again. The face was Lily's, but the eyes were gaping ebon pupils. Her mouth was hard, a black-edged grimace, as though the lips were lined with soot. "You were right, Ro," she whispered. And that was the worst of all, for the words were Katie's, Katie's voice echoing from the mouth of this filthy apparition. "We don't have room for special people here." She lurched forward, and Ro scrambled away, stumbling behind one of the 10 pews that lined the right side of the church. "No saved people," Lily rasped. "No chosen people, only everyone. All together." A shadow darted forward into the light, Yusuf snarling, his hands up and hooked into claws, and Ro felt a wild burst of relief, because even though he didn't understand everything about the child, he knew what it was capable of. Lily turned on Yusuf and snarled, a sound with no more humanity than the grunt of a pig. Yusuf flinched, as if struck, and fell to the ground, twitching. In the corner, Gavin gave a low moan and wrapped his arms around his head, covering his eyes. Lear was nowhere to be seen. He had collapsed in one of the pews. "We were such good friends," the apparition whispered, its voice sibilant, the sound of an animal carcass being dragged across stone. "Why do you run away?" Ro turned and dashed down the row of pews, but when he glanced behind him, there she was, at the end of his row, even closer than she had been before. She smiled at him, and he saw that her teeth were needles.
"Katie?"
he asked. And then, his mouth full of dark horror,
Lily?
Katie? Lily? Oh, Ro.
It giggled, raising its arm, and Ro saw that it was holding a spade. Not one of the small gardening tools the town used at harvest, but a broad, flat spade, tall as a man, its head dripping blood. He fled then toward the doorway, where blessed sunlight poured in, thinking, God, get me out of this, please, and I'll be the man they think I am, Brother Ro, Father Ro, anything, only... He was no more than 5 feet away when the doors slammed shut, and he ran into them full speed, bouncing off and falling to the ground with blood seeping into his left eye, a swirl of blackness over the vision in his right. How can this be? His mind demanded, wild and hectoring. We planned it so well. They performed so well. How can this be? Nearby, he heard the dragging crunch of feet coming closer and squeezed his eyes shut. When he was a child, he hadn't thought of this in so long. He had been afraid of monsters in his room at night, but if he closed his eyes long enough, they always went away. What he wouldn't give to be back there, curled up in his bed, 5 years old. Fingers grabbed his shoulders, their tips like claws, and Ro was jerked to his feet. He opened his good eye and found those deep black pupils staring directly into his. When it spoke, its breath wafted through those needle teeth, and it was the smell of the crypts that a 13-year-old Ro had pried open, looking for treasure, not sure yet what he meant to do. But he knew he had the will to get it done, even then. I defend this land, Roland Finn. No one wants to know how I do it. But I do. Ro began to scream. Katie woke up gradually, with the sense of having slowly broken free of an unfathomable dream. She was lying on the floor in the middle of the church, just in front of the pulpit where Ro had given so many of his sermons over the years. Something cold lay against her chest, and after a moment she realized that it was the silver chain, Jonathan's sapphire, around her neck. Raising her head, she saw a body lying several feet away. It looked like Jonathan, but it couldn't be. The two of them had just come up the staircase. She dragged herself to her knees and crawled over to him, turned him over. Jonathan's dead eyes stared up at her. Katie barely felt surprised. A dim corner of her mind murmured that she had always known it ended this way. Of course she had. William Tyr had told her. But lack of surprise did not mute her grief. A choking sound came from the far side of the church. Katie looked around wildly and saw Gavin, crouched in the corner, his wide eyes upon her. "What did you do?" she demanded, though the venom in her voice was buried beneath tears. What did you do to him? Gavin shook his head, his face whitening with panic. Not me, I swear! She pushed herself to her feet and strode over to him. As she came, Gavin wrapped his arms around himself and drew into a tiny ball in the corner, his voice breaking with panic. Please, Katie, I'm sorry. I'm sorry. For a moment she hesitated over him, thinking how good it would feel to kill him, how easy and pleasurable and fair. But the thought of Jonathan's corpse lying behind her held her back. She turned and found that the church doors were wide open, a beautiful summer day pouring into the aisle. Outside, she could hear the distant shouts of children at the park.
None of it seemed to connect to what she saw in here. Jonathan's body, Gavin cowering in the corner. We were coming up the stairs, she thought. And then... At the far end of the aisle near the doors, she saw a wide, dark pool that looked like oil. But when she ventured closer, the smell hit her like a slap, and she saw the lift and buzz of innumerable insects around the puddle, flies and gnats. Near the puddle lay a glimmering object. When Katie drew closer, she saw that it was a blue jewel on a silver necklace. She turned back to Gavin and asked, "Where's Roe?" Gavin began to sob, and this made her so angry that she strode over and slapped him in the face. "It's all well and good to cry now, you little shit. What are we supposed to do?"
"I don't know."
Disgusted, she left him and picked up Rose's necklace. The chain was sticky with blood, but she wiped it clean with her shirt sleeve, her movements almost absent, clutching the sapphire in her hand. Roe should never have had it anyway. It wasn't his to begin with. He had cheated to get it. Her eyes fell on Jonathan's corpse again, and she felt tears leak down her cheeks. Not only for Jonathan, but for all of it. The town's ruined potential, so far sunk as to allow whatever had happened here. She bent to Jonathan's body, stroking his hair from his forehead. All those years of keeping him from harm, and this was how it ended. And yet, deep down, she was confused, for beneath the clear outcome she saw here, Roe vanished, Jonathan in a heap on the floor, she sensed that nothing was right. This was not how it ended. Just beneath this almost scene was a different ending. Jonathan dead, yes, but she had never seen his body. She had fled and gone, leaving Roe and Gavin to whatever hell might await traitors to the town. But even as she tried to make it come clear, this second vision vanished, dissipated in smoke. She had not fled. She was still here. And in the thought, Katie felt responsibility descend upon her like a mantle. "Gavin, get up." He looked up at her, his eyes wide and fearful. He was only 20, Katie thought, and it baffled her that an age that had once seemed so ancient now stood revealed as almost unbearably young. In that moment, Katie thought that she could even have pitied Roe, who, after all, had been nearly as young and stupid as the rest of them. "Get up!" Gavin bolted to his feet, and Katie saw that he was afraid of her. "Well and good. You helped break this town, Gavin." He gulped, his eyes flicking involuntarily to Jonathan's body, and Katie nodded as she read his unspoken thought. "No room for tears, you said. But I'm not a tear, and neither are you. Neither is Lear, or Howell, or Morgan, or Alain. You helped Roe break this place. Now you're going to help me fix it. Do you understand?" Gavin nodded wildly. His fingers crept up toward his forehead as though he meant to cross himself, but at the last moment his hand dropped away, and he stood bewildered. "Waiting for instructions," Katie thought contemptuously. Well, Gavin had always needed someone to tell him what to do. She finished cleaning blood from Rose's necklace, using her spit where it had begun to cake, polishing until the sapphire looked good as new. She considered putting the chain over her head, but at the last moment she paused, not sure why. Some long-buried fear that demanded caution, that spoke of ghosts. After another moment's thought, she slipped the sapphire into her pocket. In the long years afterward, Caitlin Tyr would think often on this necklace, and sometimes she would draw it out and stare at it. Once or twice she even considered putting it on. But she never did. Kelsey woke to a bright, sunlit room. Not her room in the keep. She had never seen this place before. It was a room of white-painted walls, small but neat, with a desk and chair, and two bookshelves filled with books. The light came from a large glass window over the desk. A small, exploratory wriggle told Kelsey that she was lying in a narrow single bed. My room. The thought came from nowhere, from a distant corner of her brain that seemed to still be half asleep. Kelsey sat up, pulled the covers back, and swung her feet onto the floor. Sheets, pillows, floors. Everything in this room seemed incredibly clean. She was so used to the keep, where boots tracked mud and everyone was too busy to be bothered about it. But someone clearly cleaned this room. I do, Kelsey thought. Again, the thought was odd, alien, accompanied by a flash of memory. Sweeping the floor with an old, serviceable broom. What happened? She wondered. How did it end?
Kelsey? Breakfast?
The voice made her jump. It was a woman. Mum. But the sound was muffled, as though she were calling from a floor down. Kelsey pushed herself up from the bed, and as she did so, she felt the familiarity of this place solidify in her mind. This was her room, ever since she was little. Over there was the door to her closet, which was filled with the sort of clothing she favoured. A few dresses for fancy occasions, but mostly comfortable pants and sweaters. This was her desk. These were her books. She lingered beside the bookshelf, looking over the titles. Some of these books she knew, and she pulled them down and opened them, relieved to find words on each page. Here was Tolkien. Here was Faulkner. Here was Christie, Morrison, Atwood, Wolfe. But she did not recognize the editions. They were in good condition, clearly well cared for. She knew these books, even their spines. Some of them she had loved since childhood.
Kelsey!
The voice sounded closer, and she cast an almost panicked look at the doorway. Her mind drew a blank. My name is Kelsey, she told herself. At least I know that much. My name hasn't changed. She hurried over to the closet and pulled out pants and a blue sweater. The floor of her closet was littered with empty boxes, and Kelsey stared at these for a moment before she remembered. Of course. She was getting ready to move out. But to where? Her mind felt as though it were filled with mineshafts, tunnels that hid this life from her gaze. She was supposed to be packing up her room, but she had been dawdling for the past couple of weeks, not wanting her belongings to be boxed away where she couldn't get to them. When she was dressed, Kelsey opened her bedroom door cautiously, as though expecting to find dragons on the other side. She saw a short hallway, with several closed doors, and ahead of her, a descending staircase. On the wall near the top of the stairs hung a floor-length mirror, simply constructed of glass and wood. She smelled eggs cooking.
Kelsey Riley, get down here this minute. You'll be late for work.
Riley, she murmured to herself. That was right. There was no Glynn here, no Barty or Carlin, because she had never been fostered. She had grown up her entire life right here in this house. And now she was tired of it, tired of having Mum wake her up in the mornings, tired of having Mum know all of her business. She loved Mum, but Mum drove her crazy. Kelsey wanted a place of her own. That was why she was moving out. She moved toward the stairs, still half in a dream, but a glance in the mirror brought her to another halt. Her own face stared back at her. She put a hand on the smooth surface of the mirror, her eyes searching hungrily. Here was a girl of 19, with a round, good-natured face and bright green eyes. A step backward showed that she had a solid, well-fed figure. Not Lily, this woman. Her appearance neither pretty nor remarkable. And yet Kelsey could have stared at her forever. My own face. Kelsey! After a last look, she went on down the stairs. At the bottom, she found an open doorway leading into a dining area. There were plates on the table, not bulky stoneware, but fine ceramic work, blue on white. She touched the edge of one plate and found it smooth. There you are! She turned and saw Elissa Raleigh, standing in a tiny kitchen that opened off the dining room. She had a spatula in one hand and a plate in the other. She looked frazzled.
Here, have breakfast.
She shoved the plate into Kelsey's hand.
I've no time this morning. I have to be over at Mrs. Clement's. Her daughter's getting married and she wants the most ridiculous dress.
Kelsey took the plate, feeling this lock into her mind, another solid piece of information. Her mother was a dressmaker.
Go, go! You're going to be late as well.
Her mother pushed her toward the table, and Kelsey sat down. She felt herself drifting, almost becoming untethered. No one would have recognized Queen Elissa, because there was no Queen Elissa, never had been. Kelsey had never felt less like eating. She could only watch her mother bustle around the kitchen, putting things away, occasionally vanishing through an open door that, Kelsey knew, led to the cold pantry. A dressmaker, her mind whispered. Kelsey could accept that, but she felt the rest of it, the world beyond this house, looming over her, a vast unknown. Who was her father?
Time for me to run, her mother said. Give me a hug.
Kelsey looked up at her, stunned and angry, as though she would embrace this woman who had done so many selfish things. Or had she? Kelsey felt suddenly lost, wandering the vast gap inside herself, the chasm between the world she had always known and this kitchen. Queen Elissa had wrecked the Tearling, but this was not Queen Elissa. The woman before her was vain, perhaps. Kelsey sensed that this had been a point of contention between them for a long time, but she was no destroyer of kingdoms.
Kelsey?
Her mother asked, frowning, and Kelsey knew that some sense of what she'd been feeling must have shown on her face.
I know you're anxious to move out, Kel. I was at your age, too. But I will miss you. Can I have a hug?
Kelsey stared at her for a long moment, trying to push the past away, or at least make some peace with it. She had never been a forgiving person.
It was too easy a journey from anger to resentment. But her mind demanded a basic level of fairness, and that fairness said that her mother was no danger to anyone. Could Kelsey really hold her responsible for that other life, when this mother made no decisions, only clothing? Moving stiffly, as though she were manipulating someone else's limbs, Kelsey stood up and put her arms around her mother. Her mother, whom she knew so well, and yet not at all. As they hugged, she was inundated with a bright scent, something like lemons. "Have a good day, love," her mother told her, and then she dashed from the kitchen, leaving Kelsey staring at her full plate. A clock, hanging over the sink, chimed, telling her that it was 9 o'clock. She had to be at work at 9:30. "But where do I work?" she asked the empty space. She couldn't remember, but she knew the way to go. On the street outside, Kelsey had to pause. The houses, for one thing, they were so neat. Clean, new-painted wooden houses set close together. A forest, not of trees, but of white cupolas and gables, climbing the hillside above. No fences bounded them. Many of the yards boasted oak trees, and several had been laid with flower beds, but otherwise they shared space. And here was something Kelsey had only seen through Lily's eyes in the falsely cheerful neighborhoods of pre-crossing New Canaan. Mailboxes. One in front of each house. Stunned, almost dazed, Kelsey wandered down their front path to the street. She noted their mailbox, bright yellow with the number 413 painted on it in red. The street was busy. Horse-drawn wagons passed every few seconds, and people hurried by, clearly on their way to work as well. Everything seemed tidy and prosperous, but that made Kelsey think again of New Canaan. She saw many good things here, but were they real? Without thinking, she turned right and hurried up the street along with the rest of them, the same route she took to work every morning, but her eyes searched everywhere, looking for answers. She felt as though something had eluded her. Something so elementary that her mind refused to acknowledge. She had walked more than half a mile before it hit her. She had passed many people on this street. Laborers dressed in stained clothes and dragging their tools. Well-dressed men and women who seemed to be heading for some sort of office. Haulers transporting all manner of goods covered with canvas in their wagons. But nowhere did she catch a glint of armor. Not even the telltale bulkiness of a cloak that told of armor concealed beneath. And on the back of this realization came another. She had seen no steel. No swords, no knives. Kelsey peered at the people who passed her, looking for the hint of a hilt, of a scabbard. But there were none. What did we do? Obeying the habit of her feet, Kelsey followed the road to its end, then turned left onto a broad road that she recognized as the Great Boulevard. There were the same rows of shops, with their cheerful awnings, milliners, chemists, shodders, grocers. But something was different. And again, the difference was so fundamental that at first Kelsey could not identify it, could only move forward, footsteps wandering, mind far away. She glanced to her right and came to a dead halt. The window in front of her was full of books. Someone ran into her, and for a moment Kelsey lost her balance before a man grabbed her arm, holding her up. "I'm sorry," he called over his shoulder, hurrying away. "Late for work." Kelsey nodded numbly, then turned back to the window. The books were arranged in an artful display, several risers ascending in a pyramid shape. Kelsey saw books she recognized. Filth, The Great Gatsby, We Have Always Lived in the Castle. But many more she had never heard of. In This Burning World by Matthew Lynn, Léger Demain by Marina Ellis, a host of other books that had never sat on Carlin's shelves. The hand-lettered poster above the display simply read, Classics. Kelsey backed up a few feet, being more careful now to avoid the oncoming rush of people heading to work, and was rewarded with another hand-painted sign. This one hanging beneath the awning that covered the shop. Copperfield's Books, the sign read. The shop was closed. The room behind the display was still dark. Kelsey walked up to the door and tried to peer inside, but she could see very little. The door was made of some sort of tempered glass, designed to block light. She had seen such glass in Mort Main, in the Red Queen's chambers, but nothing like it had ever made its way into the Tierling before. Kelsey backed away and returned to staring at the display. It was a bookshop. Her favorite bookshop. Most of the books on her shelves at home had been purchased right here. It was her favorite place to come on a Saturday afternoon. A clock chimed somewhere, several streets over, startling her. It was already 9:30. She would be late for work. And despite her wonder, long-time instinct kicked in and got her moving again. She was never late for work. She hurried up the boulevard, keeping hold of her bag so that it would not bounce against her hip, just as she had done every day since she had graduated school at the age of 17. And yet something was different here. Something so different that... Great God, she whispered. She was standing in the middle of the great boulevard, staring down more than a mile of road. She had been here once before, in this very spot, on the day she and Mace first came to the city. And she remembered how the keep had loomed over them as they approached, titanic, casting its long shadow down the boulevard. But now, there was no keep. Kelsey stared down the road for a long moment before she could fully confirm this fact for herself. Where the shadow of the keep should have been, there was nothing. Only the distant silhouette of more buildings where the boulevard rolled over the hilltop. Seeing this, Kelsey turned her head to the right, searching automatically for that other bulwark of the new London horizon, and found no Arvath. Kelsey stared at the empty horizon for a long time. "Carlin, do you see this?" she whispered. And somehow she thought that Carlin did. She began walking again, trying to work out what this meant. No keep? No Arvath? What did these people have? Who was running this city? She dug in her mind, hoping that it would come up with this answer as well. But nothing came. She would have to fill the blanks in as she went. "Fine," she muttered. "I will." Her steps took her to the right now, off the boulevard and onto a narrow street that should have led to the outskirts of the Gut, but even a glance was enough to tell Kelsey that the Gut had changed as well. The warren of run-down leaning houses and smoking chimneys now appeared to be a thriving commercial district. Neat copper plaques hung outside each door advertising professional services. An accountant, a dentist, a doctor, an attorney. "What did we do?" her mind asked again. and now the voice was Katie's, demanding answers, demanding assessment. But Kelsey felt as though she needed to be very careful here. Demaine, after all, had also looked like a pleasant, prosperous city from the outside. She was at work. Kelsey looked up at the structure in front of her, a brick building several stories tall. Each floor had many windows. Kelsey couldn't get used to the sight of all this glass. And the front door was accessed by broad steps, made for many people to climb. Kelsey looked down and found another sign, this one bolted to the ground. New London Public Library. She stared at this sign for a long time, until the clock chimed another quarter hour, and she realized that she had to get moving, that she really was late for work. She went up the stone steps, opened a glass door, and found herself in a cool, cavernous room. These windows must be tempered as well, she realized, to keep out the heat. Everywhere she looked, she saw high, stacked shelves of books. She could not even begin to guess how many there were. Dimly, Kelsey realized that this was the most extraordinary thing she'd seen today. But she could not wonder at it. It seemed that her capacity for astonishment had been exhausted. She loved this library, but it was her workplace. She passed behind the checkout desk, which was unmanned, the library didn't open until 10, and went downstairs into the labyrinth of offices on the basement floor. Her co-workers waved to her as she passed, and Kelsey waved back, knowing each of their names, but she did not want to talk to them. She only wanted to sit down at her desk. She was in the middle of an enormous project, she remembered now. A wealthy man had died, leaving the library all of his books, and they needed to be cleaned and categorized. It was soothing work.
Kelsey?
She turned, and there was Carlin, standing behind her. For a moment, Kelsey thought it was simply another phase of a dream. With some bemusement, she saw that Carlin was wearing the exact same pair of reading glasses that she had always worn in the cottage. But the disapproval on Carlin's face was too familiar, too sharp.
"You're late," Carlin said.
Her tone implied that it would have been preferable for Kelsey to be dead. "I'm sorry."
"Well, it's only the first time, but you don't want to have a second, understand?"
"Yes." Carlin disappeared back into the nearest office, closing the door behind her, and Kelsey was not at all surprised to see another plaque on this door. Carlin Glynn, Head Librarian. After a moment, she continued down the hallway with uncertain steps. She wondered whether she had gone mad. Perhaps this was simply another fugue, another reality that lived somewhere on the far borders of the Tierling she knew. What if it isn't? She halted in the middle of the hallway, arrested by this thought. Was it possible? What if the three of them, Kelsey, Lily, Katie, had actually done it, taken past, present, and future, and somehow welded them into this place? Mankind's oldest dream, Kelsey thought, and deep in her mind she heard Tyr's voice. William Tyr, who had seen this place in visions long before anyone else even knew that the Tierling might be real. "No guns? No surveillance, no drugs, no debt, and greed holds no sway at all." But was that this place? The idea seemed impossible to Kelsey, to whom even small victories had always come with a price. Even if the world before her eyes was not a dream, but solid, surely there would be a downside. Something to undercut everything she had seen. Surely, there would be a cost. She reached her office. Kelsey Raleigh, junior librarian.